This audience is probably very familiar with the fact that the teen birth rate in the U.S. has risen from 2005 to 2007, 5%. But you may not be as aware of the fact that our rates have consistently been 2 to 4 times higher than other developed countries, especially in Europe. And there's 3 major factors that contribute to our very high rates. Certainly the promotion of abstinence till marriage policies, barriers to contraception for teens, and particularly the very high levels of social disadvantage in the U.S. compared to other highly developed countries. And it's this third factor that I'm going to be addressing in this presentation. U.S. policies also tend to frame early childbearing as very costly for mothers, for teen mothers, children, and taxpayers, but they also tend to downplay the social determinants of early childbearing. So today what I'm going to do is review the state-of-the-art studies that address the costs and poor outcomes of early childbearing, and then review the federal policies that target teen mothers in light of this evidence. So you're probably all very familiar with all the costs of early childbearing. We hear it in policy debates. We see it in the clinical literature and in many, many studies. The most recent study that's looked at public expenditures related to teen childbearing estimates $9.1 billion based on teen mothers' use of public services and lost tax revenue for teen mothers and their children. And, you know, there's been, ever since the 1970s, a great deal of research that enumerates poor birth outcomes for teen mothers and poor outcomes related to health, cognitive problems, behavioral problems for their young children. There's also quite a number of studies that also examine outcomes for among teen mothers' older offspring, adolescents, and adult offspring, and they've also enumerated all kinds of poor outcomes. And of course, with teen mothers, you know, you're all familiar, I'm sure, with the fact that it's generally attributed to early childbearing, poor education of teen mothers, poor job skills, associations with poverty, and welfare use. And all these studies have contributed to the view that teen mothering risks the future of mother and child, and the corollary to that is that if we could only get teens to stop having children till their 20s, that the costs would be reduced and the outcomes would be vastly improved. Well, there's also a growing body of literature since the 1990s that has really challenged all these the high costs of teen childbearing. The most critical factor is that teen mothers are just disproportionately disadvantaged as children compared to older childbearers. And the vast amount of research has never addressed this these background risk factors that lead teens to become mothers in the first place. So not only are teen mothers disadvantaged well before the pregnancy, but then their early childhood disadvantage is compounded by inferior schools, environmental threats, limited educational and occupational opportunities for them. So background risk factors that have generally been unmeasured in many, many studies of the outcomes of teen parenting predispose youth to early childbearing, and they also contribute to unfavorable maternal child outcomes, not only for teen mothers, but also for older mothers who share the same social background. So there's also these growing numbers of really state-of-the-art studies show that the costs and poor outcomes of early childbearing have been terribly over-exaggerated. There's one study that it's a small study, but it actually looked at the public expenses of early childbearing and showed that with this small sample, that the public expenses related to teen childbearing would actually be increased rather than decreased if they waited to have their children. And that's because teen mothers tend to work many more years compared to older women. These state-of-the-art studies also tend to show that the birth and child outcomes for teen mothers are not any worse than older child bearers who share similar social backgrounds. It's a wash. And the few studies that have also addressed and controlled for early disadvantage of the teen mothers also show that older offspring, too, are not disadvantaged by having a teenage mother. And then there's a number of studies that when they control for social disadvantage of teen mothers show that in terms of their education, income, mental health, and physical health, they do pretty much the same as older child bearers from the same social background. So the evidence from all these studies, and they're growing, is that teen mothers and their children are disadvantaged slightly, if at all, by a teen birth. And then there's a large number of studies, primarily qualitative, that show that teen mothering is often a rite of passage and actually reduces risk-taking. And yet, the ongoing claims in the clinical literature, in the policy literature, continue to suggest that early childbearing contributes to poverty and poor outcomes. Now, sort of what I'm doing in this paper is to show how all the costs attributed to early childbearing have fueled downstream policies. And I'm going to look at three federal policies. First, welfare reform. That was begun in 1996. As you know, it really focused on working among women and for teen mothers staying in school or going back to school with very strict time limits and sanctions. And there were two provisions in the TANF bill specifically targeting teen mothers, and that required that teen mothers live with responsible adults and that they also attend school. Now, when you look at the studies, though, the vast majority of teen mothers were living at home with their families anyway before TANF. And a lot of the results based on these studies demonstrate are very poor or contradictory kind of evidence. And I can speak to that later. Another group of the TANF was also designed to promote marriage. But in the reauthorization of TANF in 2005 promoted marriage, but it was modeled, this new policy direction was modeled on programs for middle-class couples and sort of so didn't address the fact that low-income women, including teen mothers, there's so many impediments to marriage among low-income couples, and that includes chronic distress, few marriageable partners, limited services for health and substance abuse, widespread mistrust between low-income men and women, and then multi-partner fertility. And all of the marriage promotion policies never addressed that. It assumed sort of a middle-class bias. And in fact, there's been now at least seven studies, maybe more, that have promoted marriage among low-income couples, and they've not been proven effective at all. And although marriage promotion policies don't address teen mothers per se, the studies that have been done that look at this, teen mothers, their marriages are very unstable. They're often associated with a very closely spaced second birth, and tends to dampen the educational gains, at least for teen mothers who stay married. The third policy I want to look at is what's happened in education. Now, this preceded TANF by many, many years. 1972, Title IX of the Educational Amendments Act prohibited in public high schools the exclusion of pregnant parenting and married teens from school. But that doesn't mean that there were many, many ways that schools continue to discriminate against teen parents. But this was a huge advance. But what many urban schools did to address this was that they established urban school districts, many of them established separate classrooms or programs as long as they were comparable to a regular high school program. Well, in fact, they weren't really comparable, but they failed to provide, most of the school districts who opted in this direction failed to provide comparable programs or the services that would help them remain in school. So as a group, teen mothers are more likely than older child bearers to experience a lot of childhood inequities and background risk factors that contribute to high teen birth rates and poor maternal child outcomes. But many teen mothers make educational and income gains as adults when there's resources available to do that. And this is particularly pertinent with teens who come from middle class backgrounds. They actually, you know, make advances in their schooling and income when there's resources available. But the cumulative impact of disadvantage for teen mothers who, and the vast majority of them, are poor, are compounded by our downstream policies because they emphasize individual behavior change rather than looking at all those upstream factors. They tend to overlook and often reinforce the inequities associated with teen parenting to begin with, including the many, many educational and employment barriers. And they also fail to capitalize on teen mothers' aspirations and reduced risk-taking. And this is particularly true of the TANF policies. If we were to really move upstream to address the inequities that contribute to teen parenting, we'd be providing legal protections, which in fact the educational reform did, just that, and it's certainly made some difference. It's to improve teen mothers' educational access and improve the programs, especially in urban school districts, but in other high schools too, and to promote their economic security. Now, the U.S. is a real anomaly in this whole area, both in supporting families and teen families, and in decreasing child poverty. In fact, the U.K., Great Britain, since 1999, has made really dramatic progress in moving upstream to support working and non-working and poor parents and investing in education. For example, they established a national minimum wage that's that's higher than the U.S. They established a tax credit, much like the EITC here, the tax credit for low-income working families, but it's much more generous than the U.S. policy. Paid leaves for new parents, and quite generous, actually, for working parents. And lots of investments in universal early childhood education with guaranteed childcare subsidies for low-income parents. You'll notice we don't do much of this. I mean, our minimum wage is very low compared to what came about in Great Britain. So really, to move upstream to address the disadvantage that contributes to early parenting and the poor outcomes with early parenting, it would mean early childhood education, much stronger public education, dropout recovery programs, smooth transitions to college or vocational education. A lot of these are in effect in Europe, actually. Economic development and job creation, universal health care, reproductive health care, comprehensive sex education, and in the U.S., repairing the welfare as a safety net, rather than what our welfare policy has done by working downstream, is to make poor women work without the supports and the education to really make a difference. So, social injustice is deeply implicated in early childbearing. A lot of the research, we've tended to exaggerate by exaggerating the cost of early childbearing, that is sort of undermined by the newer research, that early childbearing doesn't increase the costs per se when you really look at their prior disadvantage, but the exaggerated costs have fueled downstream policies in the U.S., all the welfare reform, all that kind of thing. And so postponing pregnancy without addressing these early social inequities actually have very little tangible effect. We need instead to be advocating for upstream policies and really challenging the stereotypes of teen parents that the downstream policies actually promote a lot of those stereotypes. In closing, Lillian Wald and the Henry Street settlement, it's really a very powerful example of working upstream, both with individuals, families, and policy to address the early inequities to make a difference. And it's just so important to work upstream to really promote and to challenge the risks that are generally associated with early childbearing, but those risks tend not to look at the fact that teen mothers come to be mothers because of all their early disadvantage. So, I don't know if there are time for a few questions. Yes. Well, the education, public schools can no longer discriminate against pregnant and parenting teens. That came into effect in 1972. But what many areas, school districts did was develop special school programs for pregnant and parenting teens, and those programs, there's lots of flaws with those programs, and there's been many, many ways that teen parents have continued to be discriminated against in the school systems, and there's been many suits against that too. For example, there's programs that wouldn't allow them, if they succeeded and did really well in high school, to become part of the National Honor Society, and there's lots and lots of discrimination against in the school system by teen parents, and the teen pregnancy programs that were established partly to help teen mothers succeed actually have serious limitations. They don't provide the same access to college prep programs, all kinds of things. So that's one of the legal protections from teen mothers, but many school districts there's been lawsuits against some of the inequities, like that they can't become part of the Honor Society, the national, what do you call that? CSF. Pardon me? CSF. I'm not sure. That they're discriminated against because they can't become part of the National Honor Society, things like that. Schools in many ways continue to discriminate against teen parents. But the legal protection is there since 1972 to some extent, but schools aren't necessarily doing a great job with that. Yes?
Well, thank you. And actually, if I can ask that we hold, sure. The question, we'll have time at the end right now, if that's okay. And